Hi, this is Jason Bradford.
I'm Asher Miller.
And I'm Rob Dietz. Welcome to Crazy Town, where Black Friday meets the Black Death. Hey, Jason, Asher, you guys ever watch The Brady Bunch?
Of course.
Can I confess something?
Of course.
The Brady Bunch, I would give them about 30% credit for me learning English.
Really?
Yeah. So when I moved to the United States, I was 7 years old, and I knew only a couple, well, I knew a few words in English, and we spent a lot of time watching Brady Bunch on TV. So I know how to say pork chops and applesauce and
so wait,
those kinds of things really.
You were a Dutch speaker before?
Israeli speaker when I moved to the U.S., yeah.
They call it Israeli, is the language?
Well, it was Hebrew.
Okay, thank you.
I was from Israel.
I thought I was screwed up in the head, but I'm not.
So you replaced whatever you were speaking with just, gee golly willikers.
Exactly. Yeah, that's, and I spoke with a lisp.
Okay, so we're dating ourselves horribly. For those who don't know, if we have any young listeners out there, the Brady Bunch
was
this.
We just lost them.
Yeah, I know, right? It was this really bad but iconic American sitcom that came out, what, in the probably early 70s.
You sound like a historian.
Yeah, well, it was before my time. I would watch it in syndication, when I got home from school. But look, the reason I bring it up is there was this particularly memorable episode to me where the boys are... Oh, I even got to back it up a sec. So just to set this up, right, you had two adults who are on their second marriage to each other, and each one of them brought three children in, right? So you had Mike Brady with his three sons, and you had Carol with her three daughters, and it became the Brady Bunch, right?
How impressed are you, Jason, that Rob knows, like, their first names?
I'm just shocked.
I remember Alice, the live-in maid.
The boys were Greg, Peter, and Bobby.
Okay.
The girls are Marcia, Jan, and Cindy.
Yeah, and what was Alice's boyfriend?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sam.
That's good.
There you go. The dog was Tiger.
I know. Jesus.
They did the old trope of every sitcom, like where when it gets stale, you got to bring in a cute young kid. They brought in Oliver.
He wasn't cute. He was annoying.
Is he a foster kid or something?
I don't know. So, yeah, they probably found him in the doghouse or something.
Okay.
Look,
this suddenly turned into the Brady Bunch Memory Lane show.
Let's move it. Let's move along here. Let's move along. Let's talk about Hogan's Heroes after you finish with this.
Let's not turn this into an ancient television podcast. So the reason I'm bringing it up is one of the memorable episodes that I recall is the boys are playing basketball in the house and they're not supposed to. Mama Brady always says, don't play ball in the house. And Peter accidentally breaks her favorite vase, right? They're like, oh my God, because he wanted to go camping that weekend and he was going to get grounded because he broke the vase. So they're like, what do we do? What do we do? And they decide they're going to hide it. And they super glue this thing back together and they stick it up in the table and put the flowers in it. And over the course of dinner, what do you suppose happens?
Alice has to clean up a mess because she's the maid.
You got it. They can't clean up their own messes. You gotta farm that out to the housekeeper. Alice. The vase starts cracking along the super glued lines. It's fracturing on these fault lines, and of course the kids have to own up to it. Blah blah blah.
Good lessons.
Yeah, really good lessons.
Yeah,
but
I learned my ethics from Brady Bunch as well.
So why are we talking about this?
Well, so this kind of gets us to our most recent episodes of this very show where we were pointing out some of the fault lines in American society, things that are going on in the political realm that aren't working out too well for us. And the reason I thought of the whole Brady Bunch stuff, Asher, is in a conversation you and I had recently, we were talking about how in trouble America seems to be. And you made a really cool metaphor about, look, when you have a vase and it's got some cracks in it and you knock into that vase, it breaks right along those fault lines. And of course, my idiot brain goes straight to the Brady Bunch with that.
Right. You poor thing.
I know. Good God. But it got me thinking about the fault lines that were already existing in American society before the coronavirus pandemic really started to play out.
Oh, God.
We talked about this because there are all these, I felt like there's a slew of articles coming out, like all saying, you know, the pandemic broke America.
No, we were already cracked.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. And maybe if you want to say it broke America, well, how did it break America? How is it broken? What does it look like? And it is along these fault lines, I think.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be kind of cool to go through what are some of those fault lines and let's
cool
see.
Cool or find. Depressing, maybe? Like, which one is that?
Well, yeah, maybe depressing, but maybe by looking at them, we could come up with, well, what are some examples of how those fault lines are really showing up under what's happening with coronavirus? And maybe then we can think about how do we go about gluing this in a different way from what Greg, Bobby, Peter, Jan, Marcia, and Cindy did in the Brady Bunch. You know, maybe there's a better path we can talk about. Let's go through some of these. Let me introduce a fault line in American society. And it's one that stuck with me for years. And this is the undermining of the legitimacy of government, but also the competency of government. And what I wanted to bring up here is this has been going on for decades. Probably the best resource I've seen on this is Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money, which is about the history of how billionaires funded the rise of the radical right. Basically, you got libertarians like the Koch brothers trying to undermine, underfund, get rid of anybody competent in government. And they're like master strategists. They made this happen over decades with incredible persistence. You guys know about this?
I've heard about
it. I read the book.
Oh, good. Good for you guys.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, so I think they pursued three pathways really well. One of them was setting up all these think tanks that could respond to any news story with a refutation or, you know, their idea of how things are supposed to be.
A framing, really. Putting in their framing, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you've heard a lot of these groups like the Heritage Foundation, the Club for Growth, Competitive Enterprise Institute.
No, wait. These are... Think about how we can fuck over everybody but our funders' tanks. Okay, let me just...
Yeah, but that's too long of a description, so right. They just went with think tank.
Okay, oh, sorry. Okay, continue.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting because the reason it's called dark money is they went out of their way to hide the fact that they were funding groups like that. But that was kind of phase one, I think, is getting these think tanks or whatever the hell you called them, Jason, up and running.
Well, this is great because now... You know what we got? We have Jared Kushner as the guy that's supposed to come up with a plan for peace in the Middle East. That's like on every president's agenda, right? And this term, it's Jared's job. That's what we've sunk to.
Maybe, at least according to his logic, that's okay, right? If all the presidents have failed, maybe he'll get it right.
That's actually his logic. I'm not strapped by any preconceived notions of any learnedness that I've ever had, so I can figure this out. Oh, but he did get an associate's degree from Dunning-Kruger Community College. So there's that going for him.
Don't knock associate's degrees. Look, I'll just say this about Kushner. That was not about actually trying to come up with a legitimate Middle East peace plan. That's about trying to secure the Jewish vote in the United States.
This is not about competently actually getting anything done. It's actually about being strategically incompetent in regard to what you're saying you're supposed to be doing.
I don't think it's strategically competent or incompetent. I think it's what is the goal? The goal is to get the vote of this voting bloc. It's not to actually get peace, right?
Right.
In this case.
How do you feel, Asher, as the representative in our team here of that voting bloc?
The Jewish votes.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other conversation. You know, at least they're transparent in their utter bias. And not even their bias towards a Jewish position, but their bias towards a certain pro-Israel position, which is not necessarily the same thing. But
nepotism is the key thing. Is nepotism loyalty test? It's not about being good at anything. It's about being loyal and being connected, and that's what pisses me off.
Right, and we've had that with government. I think it's always a struggle with nepotism. It's, you know, Trump has taken it to the extreme, like he's done with a lot of things.
Yeah.
I didn't want to bring it back though to this, the idea of the competency of government and legitimacy of government. I think there is this effort of promoting a neoliberal economic worldview, which basically says unfettered capitalism, unfettered markets solve problems better than government does. And you know, we've talked about Reagan in the past, you know, the whole idea of welfare queens and basically trying to make it seem like the welfare state, the thing that was built after our last Great Depression, we might be in one now, right, was undermined over the course of decades by people who saw that as a threat to their interest, right, was basically having more progressive taxation and providing some benefit to making sure that all Americans have at least a floor beneath them. So that's attacking government, right? The thing around competence, I think, is a slightly different thing. And that is, you know, I remember this quote from Grover Norquist, who was a right-wing Republican lobbyist, and he basically admitted, he's like, their goal is to drown, get government small enough that you could drown it in a bathtub.
Starve the beast was the other term I remember. Starve the beast.
Well, and the more recent term is drain the swamp, right?
But the swamp is more maybe the nepotism and the collusion thing. I think getting government down to the size where it can't really function is really this coordinated effort, and we're now bearing the fruits of that.
Well, the irony is that Trump came in on this message of reform because he's right. There was a swamp there, but all he did is bring in even more swampier creatures.
Well, I actually have a healthy skepticism of the competency of large bureaucracies, and it doesn't matter really whether it's corporate or government or...
You were a G something, right? Weren't you a G something at one point?
Yeah, I've worked in the federal government before, but the questions around, is this a good organization to run something? Those are legitimate questions. However, that doesn't mean there is no legitimate role for government. I mean, there are clear market failures. I mean, even a neoliberal economics professor at a university will tell you there are market failures, and that's where government steps in. And we're seeing these, the dark money idea that we were just talking about, they're setting up think tanks, funding positions at universities for professors, and then aiding actual candidacies for various public offices with the role of just shutting down government, with trying to do what you're talking about, Asher, make it so small that you can drown it in an inch of water.
We have committee heads in Congress right now who basically ran on a platform of hating government.
Yeah.
And they're in government and they're running these committees. I mean, that's what we have. You know, there's always a level of incompetence. And it's a question about the size of institutions and their ability to function and respond quickly to things. But in this case, there was legitimate defunding of the CDC, dismissal of public health things, and we're reaping the consequences of that now, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I find interesting about this is, like, and maybe this is a fault line, I'm not sure. I think it will be a fault line in the future, and that is state versus federal, right? And this has always been a point of tension in this country from the very, very beginning, right? Federalist Papers, debates over the Constitution, you know, all that stuff, right? And I think you have people across the political spectrum who, in some cases, they're all kind of, they lean towards pro-state. In other cases, they want it to be federal, right? Like, and I think that there's a lot of inconsistency for people depending upon what position they hold on certain things. But what's fascinating to me about what we're seeing now is, and it's directly related to the incompetence of the federal government, the kind of the corruption of federal government, the incompetence of it, the defunding of it, is that we've effectively left states to themselves, right?
Yeah.
And on the one hand, you could look at other countries and say, this is an incredible, actually, if you step back and you say, what a social experiment to have 200 countries experiencing the same kind of crisis in different ways with their different political systems in place, different dynamics in terms of demographics of their population, whatever, right? And we're running an experiment, you know, with like 200 different countries doing this. There's things that other countries with their central governments, maybe because their populations are smaller, they've gotten wrong, the things that they've gotten right. In our case, we've got 50 governors who are really powerful.
Yeah.
And have asked in many cases for the federal government to step up. And the federal government has refused to do that.
Right.
Or has been unable to do that.
It's like, Jared, what should we do, Jared?
Right. Well, it's interesting to see them kind of growing into that power too. I think the example, certainly it's most pertinent to us, is when California, Oregon, and Washington said, okay, we're going to form our own COVID-19 response plan because we can't really rely on anything that's coming out of the federal government.
I felt a sense of relief when that happened. I went, oh, thank God, because I knew that Oregon was going to struggle because it's got limited resources. It's the smallest of those three states. And so the fact that I thought, okay, it's got friends it can rely on here, because the CDC was so lousy, the federal government was so lousy about providing any guidance, I went, okay, it's got Washington and California. We're in this group. We're in this together. We're going to be fine. We're going to have good policies now. It was a relief.
It's actually fascinating. I mean, first of all, it's not the only region that's doing that. We have that in the Northeast. Right. We've got that, yep. You know, Midwest. And I don't know if we've talked about it before on the podcast, but I've thought a lot and spoken probably ad nauseum to people over the years about, you know, my sense that as we get further and further into the 21st century, the less and less confident I would feel about this United States holding together because right. of the issues we're going to be facing with resource constraints and climate change. There are a lot of cultural differences across this country. There are differences in terms of biocapacity in different regions. And so I kind of speculate, I'm not the only one, that maybe we'll see kind of bioregional governments being formed. And it's fascinating to see. I'm not saying that this is happening now. It's going to happen, you know. But Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, has sort of talked about California as being its own country, in a sense.
He said nation state. I know.
Exactly.
Well, it's kind of unthinkable to consider the United States breaking up, at least in a short time frame. But we know from every example ever in the history of the world that any empire breaks up, any right. super large agglomeration of land breaks up. And we've seen it in our own lifetimes with the Soviet Union breaking up. So it's inevitable. It's a question of when. And, you know, we don't need to make predictions. But, you know, a lot of interesting things have been written about it. On the fictional front, it brings to mind Ecotopia, right? The goofy novel by Ernest Kallenbach about how the region to the west of the Cascades, Washington and Oregon, splits off Northern California, I guess, part of that too, maybe, yeah. and makes its own nation state, as you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, again, we are talking about fault lines here, right? So I think the fault line is really around regional and cultural differences that we have in this country. And we're clearly seeing that in terms of response to this pandemic. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it's going to play out, you know, in terms of life and death consequences of those differences. But it's one thing to hold together when things are, quote unquote, relatively stable. It's another thing to hold together when things are really fraught and dangerous and there are difficult choices to be made. So this is a clear one that's already existed in this country, has existed for a very long time. And you wonder, is there a point at which it might, even if we get through this pandemic, you know, we're going to have climate and other really, really significant crises we're going to face. Will it hold together?
Yeah, totally. I don't know. I think you're right. I immediately went to things like, is this the beginning of the end of the U.S. as a nation state? And is this just the first steps maybe, right? Part of what I think about is this differences in values. Like we talked about in previous episodes, sort of the more communitarian value set versus individualism. And mm-hmm. I feel like that's a huge fault line in the United States. Like we have taken individualism to the extreme.
extreme individualism.
Yes, exactly. And there's this, we covered this in the Politics of Contraction episode 27, but we seem to have this nation that's like founded by rebels, you know, this vast territory where we are pioneers, this, and this energy blindness that, you know, once fossil fuels were discovered, you could put them in your machine and you felt like you could do anything, right? It gives this false sense of personal agency. And then we have these books by Anne, or is it Ayn Rand? I don't know. And that popularized...
I love calling her that. She would hate it so much. That would make me so happy.
Did you know her?
Oh, yeah. I knew her. We were tight.
Okay. Yeah.
She's no longer alive.
Okay. But this all popularized this hyper-libertarianism, this individual liberty notion even further. And we evolved as these humans in community. And that's what I'm afraid of, that we don't understand our need for this.
When you talked about energy blindness and the fossil fuels and people running wild, that made me think of this example. You remember that guy, what's his name? Rand again. That's a strange coincidence. This guy, Rand Abbott. So we go from Ayn Rand to Rand Abbott. You remember him? He had 5 minutes of fame.
What did he do?
So this guy, Rand Abbott, he is a rock climber who climbs the boulders in Joshua Tree National Park.
Oh, and amazing place.
It also happens that he's paraplegic. So kind of an inspiring guy, really.
Wow.
How does he do that as a paraplegic?
He must have some incredible arms and incredible balance. But his story came about during that government shutdown. I think this was back in January of 2019. So this is pre-COVID, but I think a good example of what you're talking about with the individualism, Jason. And what happened is, you know, the government shut down, whatever, couldn't come up with a budget. So then Joshua Tree, the employees weren't allowed to go in, and all the pit toilets started filling up and it was becoming a mess. So they said the park's closed. Well, the rugged individualists didn't give a shit. So they just started driving their four-wheelers off into the desert and chopping down Joshua trees, basically causing mayhem in the park. And this guy, Rand Abbott, what a kind soul. He spent thousands of his own dollars, bought a bunch of bleach and stuff, and went into the park to clean things up and to haul out trash and to...
As a paraplegic.
Yeah, basically be a protector of the park. And there was a story where they saw a guy who had like driven off into this fragile area and run over some stuff. And he went and talked to him. It's like, hey, you realize you're damaging this habitat. And the guy just gave him the finger, kind of the fuck you. I have my truck, I have my fuel, and I can go wherever the hell I want. So I think that was, to me, kind of I don't care about the habitat. I don't care about the rest of any Americans who might want to enjoy this place.
This is the problem. We have pushed the individual self-interest button over and over and over and over again, right? In order to stoke, I would say we've done it in order to stoke consumerism.
Wait a minute. Can I get an individual self-interest button from Amazon? I would be pushing that every 5 seconds. Yeah.
Jeff Bezos has one. He's pushing it constantly. But we basically created a system that is rewarding the individual, right? And we've talked about this before. It's kind of written into our founding documents, you know, the interest of the individual. And then we just put that on friggin' hyperdrive. And now when we get these situations where sacrifice and compromise and the interests of the community or the interest of the individual, right? Which is how, by the way, for... The only reason we exist as a species is because we fucking figured that out, right?
Yeah, we're a hyper-social species.
Exactly. We figured out how to work together in order to get through things, okay?
Yes.
It's the only reason we're here, buddy, for you to be able to even drive your pickup truck.
Eusocialism. That's the term for biologists use for human beings. We're a eusocialist species. We're weird in that way. But it's true. I'm a freaking biologist. I got a PhD. It wasn't from Dunning-Kruger. It was from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Wasn't Dunning-Kruger you? Jesus Christ!
I've got to step in here. I don't think most people know what Dunning-Kruger means, Jason. You're bringing this up. These are the what were they, psychologists?
Yes.
who came up with this theory that,
not a theory, they tested it.
Okay, an idea, an effect that people
it's
who
well documented.
Are ignorant. Oh, this is going to be tough. We got a. You got any Prozac or anything to share that you can put in Jason's drink?
I need a drone to fly over to his house.
So this effect is the idea that when you know very little about a topic, you have all the confidence in the world that you're an expert in it. And those who actually are expert in a topic realize, oh my God, there's a lot that I don't know. I've just scratched the surface.
I have one word for an example. Bleach.
Bleach?
You're talking about our fearless leader's idea that we should be injecting bleach into our systems to fight COVID-19?
Yes.
Dunning-Kruger. There you go, folks. Okay, Asher, please continue.
Yeah, I mean, so the fact that we have encouraged this individual self-interest, and we've told people that that is, in fact, not only have we told people that that's sort of an inalienable right for them, but healthcare and food and fresh water, fuck those things. But, you know, you being able to pursue your own self-interest at all costs is inalienable. Not only have we told people that, but we've somehow conflated it with nationalism and patriotism, right? Like, I'm actually being a good citizen by standing up and saying, screw you, I get to do what I want. So now we have these people who are basically resisting orders that are about protecting people, right? Right.
And claiming to be the most American
exactly.
of all Americans.
Right. And they're conflating this with the Second Amendment, right? Which is like,
yes.
Suddenly this is about you protecting your right to own an AR-15.
Right.
Excuse me, what is going on here? You know, now there are legitimate concerns about constitutional rights being taken away. And there's, I am concerned about a slippery slope of
yes.
putting in place provisions and laws and restrictions on behavior that could become constant. You know, like there's concerns here. But the idea that you're going to go down to the Capitol building with a gun or a bazooka, I saw in one case,
yeah,
you know what I mean? And spit in people's faces, which gets to another thing I want to bring up. And that is, imagine this. Imagine you had some black men who went down to the Capitol in Michigan or in South Carolina or wherever, Ohio, right? With guns on their back, spitting in the face of a security guard. Do you think that security guard is likely to be like, calm down, sir, please calm down. It's all going to be okay. No,
no,
they're going to shoot the guy.
Of course not. And I mean, I think you're bringing up another major fault line that was there all along in American society, which is the race and class divide, right? I mean, that hasn't happened yet with a group of armed black people going down to the state house, but you're right.
Because they're not stupid and they're not entitled, right? They know what's going to happen to them. And the fact that these yahoos can do that and get away with it is just, it's such a stark reminder of, you know, the contrast of kind of the experience of white America and the experience of people of color in the United States.
I think the only sort of consolation in thinking about this is that at least people are looking into it, studying it, and reporting what's happened as a result of our history.
Yeah.
Certainly with racial divide, we've mentioned another podcast on ours here called the Seeing White podcast, which really looked at the history of race in America and the power divide that obviously existed in the early days, but that has carried forward. We've also talked a lot about the growing income inequality in this nation, which my favorite resource on that is a book called The Spirit Level by Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson that lays out an amazing case of how America went from being one of the most equal, equitable nations on the planet to becoming one of the least since World War II.
Well, you know, we had a last season, we had Chuck Collins on the show. He's a PCA board member, and he's done some really interesting work with his group. And it's not just about income, it's about wealth, right? So the difference between sort of your how much cash you get each year versus how many assets you own. And what's amazing is that they looked at this both in the context of the COVID-19 and how the billionaires have really done really well. Like their wealth increased quite a bit in a few months by like 10%. But also that we're talking about over these sort of decades of policy to undermine government oversight and to reform tax policy to benefit the rich. Their recent report found that U.S. billionaire wealth soared over 1,100% between 1990 and 2018. But their tax obligations as a percentage of their wealth decreased by 79% between 1980 and 2018.
Well, that's part of the divide that is keeping us from feeling like we're all in this together, right? I mean, we talk a lot about shared sacrifice and how if we're going to get through the crises that are crushing us or that are coming in the future, we've got to all work together. We need to feel a sense that we're all making a sacrifice. But when you have billionaires who are actually getting richer and then the people at the bottom are actually getting worse off, like what are we doing?
Yeah, I think I wish I could attribute this to the person who coined it. And I don't know who it was, but I heard a great way of putting it, which is that we're not all in the same boat with this pandemic. We're all in the same ocean, but we're in different boats. And some of them are big ass fucking yachts, you know? And
so some of them are like that last recent episode we did where we're just floating on the door of the Titanic.
And I think, you know, back to fault lines, we're also seeing disproportionate impacts of COVID-19 on African-American populations. We're seeing a lot of really worrisome stuff happening on Native American reservations. There's this confluence, and I think this always happens, unfortunately, when there's a crisis, which is that the most disadvantaged are the most impacted by these things, right? And and it's hard to know. I'm certainly not a medical expert, and I think time will tell why there are these discrepancies that we see. But it wouldn't be surprising for me to see that there are higher rates resulting from localized pollution, let's say in urban communities that are, you know, a lot of industries put into parts of communities that are poor and disproportionately people of color. So the impacts of being exposed to those things, you know, the stress of being poor and what that does to people's health, which is not, I don't think, well documented enough. It is clear that this is not hitting people equally.
No.
And how people recover or the kind of support that they get is certainly not equal. And you wonder, these inequities, these divisions that we've had for a long time, how long are they going to last, you know, before people say enough, can't tolerate this anymore?
Asher, I have been devastated watching this and also thinking about like food system workers and how many of them are endangered, not just in meatpacking plants, but I'm thinking of like just people that picking fruit or vegetables. And all this just reminds me of this sort of the fault line I'm thinking about. It's just the excess of the profit motive, you know, the fact that we've taken this to such an extreme. You know, the idea of capitalism is you own the means of production and you're trying to get as much profit back to the owners of this. And whether it's private ownership or corporate ownership, it doesn't really matter. It all is just about maximizing that kind of financial metric, that financial return. And that means that you've got to essentially cut your costs for labor, right? And that's not cool. We're seeing then the fault line of this happening, where now suddenly we're these people who are feeding us, who are cleaning up after us, right? Who are our healthcare workers, even our EMTs. These folks often are endangering themselves, and they've been basically driven to exploitation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You see that over exploitation Of people, for sure, but also of our lands. I mean, we talk about that a lot. I think that excess of capitalism, maybe even combined with some of the other fault lines that we've mentioned, are showing up big time now in the pandemic. If you look at what the U.S. response has been to propping up people in our economy versus what other nations are doing, it's absolutely pathetic. Here in the U.S., we get a one-time $1,200 stimulus check. And I'm not scoffing at that. Yeah, not everybody. And you know, that's not a sneezable amount or, you know, something to laugh at. But when you compare to what other nations are doing that maybe don't take things to quite the extreme that the U.S. does, over in the U.K., they're guaranteeing up to 80% of your salary. In Denmark, it's 75 to 90%. In the Netherlands, it's 90%. Spain is even moving toward permanent implementation of a basic income. And we've got $1,200 in a one-time payment. So I think you're right, Jason. Capitalism to the extreme and minimizing any costs, we're seeing that fault line is expressing itself pretty badly right now.
That's evident in that it's not that the U.S. has actually spent less money. The federal government has spent less money than other governments. It's about where that money is going to, right? So we've actually put out trillions of dollars. It's like, by the way, it used to be inconceivable to think about $1 billion. Now we're talking about trillions of dollars and throwing them around, you know, like it's nothing.
Oh, Bezos is now a quadrillionaire. Exactly. It just happened. Sorry.
I mean, it's just insane, right? So, yeah. But it's really about where those trillions have gone. And there's discussion about doing another, I think it's a $2 trillion stimulus package. If you think about that money, and if you actually distributed money just to households, instead of giving it, the majority of it going to corporations, we're talking about there's 140 million households in the United States. It's over $14,000 per household.
Well, look, don't get insane here, Asher. I would rather a corporation get it, and then it trickles down to me, right? That's what I'm.
I just heard that one of our nation's grocery store chains sent a letter to all their employees. You know, they'd been giving them hero, what they called hero pay, which is basically hazard pay because these people are putting their lives at risk in order to help ensure that people didn't go hungry in this country. And they were giving them like $2 extra an hour for that hazard pay. They called it hero pay. Uh-huh. And they, not only are they discontinuing that, they send letters to people saying, oops, we realize we overpaid you. You need to pay us back.
We paid you $2.05. Hey,
we paid you too much, and we're going to be taking out in installments in your upcoming paychecks. Meanwhile, we're giving hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars to these corporations.
Okay, look, that's it. We're done roiling around in the mud and the poo of these fault lines.
It's always poo with you.
We have got to make the turn here, okay? We have got to talk about how to change things up. I think this metaphor is apropos in that, you know, like, in that Brady Bunch episode, when they super glued that damn vase back together, it actually started pissing on the table right through the fault lines. This is crazy town. So let's make some crazy proposals here in that, how about we not just glue the vase back together? How about we not reconstruct our economy and our society exactly as it was before, sort of the get back to normal? And let's talk about rebuilding something else. And one of the things we talked about recently was the adaptive cycle, and especially focusing in on that part of the cycle where you've come through some kind of a collapse, and that's the chance for a reorganization. Let's convert this into something a little bit different. And of course, what we would hope for is that the different thing would have sustainability and justice built into it so we could start erasing these fault lines. So, you know, that brings up the question is, how do we go about doing that? How do we address the way government has been undermined and delegitimized and lost some of its competence? How do we deal with too much individualism, this race and class divide, and the capitalist corporate excesses that we've seen? How do we glue things together in a way that's going to be something that we can all work with going forward?
I don't know. I'm a little befuddled. It's so outlandish what's going on. I did read something inspiring, though, a little bit. David Holmgren, we've talked about him, permaculturalist.
Founder of permaculture, right?
One of them, with Bill Mollison. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. He had a book that came out, I think it was last year or the year before, called Retro Suburbia.
Yeah.
They've been basically saying, it's the empire is going to crumble as fossil fuels wane and people are going to have to start getting back to like taking care of their own means of subsistence. We're going to have to work together. A non-monetary economy is going to arise, more household-based. We're going to withdraw our participation and support out of these larger systems as they fall apart. They will not be able to give us what we're used to. So just you lose your job. What do, right? And so slowly, perhaps tentatively, but building these alternatives is part of like this reorganization phase. He's sort of talking about how that's what we're starting to see happen. It's like, remember in the other episode, we talked about how this gardening is taking off. It's hard to find seed. And so that's kind of just one little example, but just all the sewing masks people are making masks for free and handing them out and rebuilding skills and sort of just trading with neighbors a bit. So I think that's some of this. We're going to start seeing this informal, more household neighborhood-based economy probably try to make up for this loss of this formal economy that was really exploitive.
Yeah, well, I like that notion that you found something inspiring. Same thing happened to me the other day. I was reading this article. It was a book review, sort of a preview. There's a book coming out called Humankind, A Hopeful History. And it's by this guy, Rutger Bregman. And he's got a story in there that I had never heard of. Basically, it's the antithesis to Lord of the Flies, right? I mean, you know the Lord of the Flies story where these school-age boys get stuck on an island and to make it short, they eat each other, basically. You know, like it's not quite, but it's just a
pretty bleak picture of human behavior.
Yes, yeah. It's a boy eat boy world, right? So,
and boy, does it taste good.
Right. What Bregman, he actually talks about a real event in history where this happened. A bunch of boys got stranded on this island called Ata, a deserted island. They were there for 15 months, and essentially their cooperativeness went into overdrive, and they all survived. They all got rescued. Just this amazing story. It happened in the 60s. I can't believe that it's not been made into dozens of books and movies and whatnot. Maybe after this book comes out, it'll be more popular. But that whole notion that our cooperativeness is our superpower, and it's not the competitiveness and the dog-eat-dog way that gets us through crises and that helps us build these better societies. It's this cooperativeness that we all have in us, even children.
Yeah.
And I found that really inspiring and an amazing thought for us building a better future.
You're making me feel better, Rob. Thank you.
I think, you know, thinking about these fault lines and what we could do, it's a tall order what you asked, Rob, which is, you know, how do we repair these fault lines or rebuild in a way where these fault lines don't exist anymore or aren't exposed to further shocks? I don't think there's a simple answer, but we talked about governance and the intentional undermining of proficient governance and people's belief in government. And one way to address that is to ensure that we are, as best as we can, electing people that we have confidence in who actually believe in government and want to do the best for government. And if you can't find them, run for office yourself. I'm not fucking kidding. And maybe part of it, a lot of what we talk about is at the local scale, is thinking about functional government at the local scale, where you can actually build relationships with people. So don't ignore our civic duty as citizens in this country. We have an important election coming up. It's going to be really interesting to see how that unfolds and how people vote in this time. But that's one thing. I think the other is, and this sounds a little kumbaya-ish maybe, but if, you know, we're talking about individualism versus cooperation, model it, right? I think of every day as an opportunity to model the right behavior and correct the wrong behavior. And you can correct the wrong behavior in effective ways. It's not just about, you know, you talked earlier, Rob, about this guy like at Joshua Tree flipping them off. It's not about flipping people off who aren't wearing masks or not doing their civic duty, you know, in terms of protecting other people. It's about calling in a moment and saying, hey, have you thought about the consequences of this behavior? So modeling it ourselves, asking people to step up and live their better selves in the self-interest of others, because I do think that that is intrinsic in all of us. There are some exceptions of sociopaths, you know, fuck those guys. But, you know, most people aren't that, you know. When it comes to the racial and economic stuff, not everyone is in a position to do this, but some of us are, okay? So I am fortunate to be in a position, and this is not patting myself on the back. We talked earlier about $1,200. I don't need that $1,200 right now in my life. Other people do. So my family, we donated the money that we got for all four of us. And there are many communities that need that and people that need that support. So find, if you have the resources, find that in your local community. There are really vulnerable populations. There are great causes that you could support right now to help Native American populations and on tribal lands and other groups, you know, for people who are really, really vulnerable, not just people in our own communities.
Yeah, I had read that Danny Nierenberg, a friend of ours who runs Food Tank, the food think tank, had listed these 17 Native American organizations that are working on food security. And I have not received my $1,200 yet. I may never receive it. We'll see what happens. But as I'm waiting for it to trickle down from the corporations, but I was definitely inspired to look at donating to one of the organizations that's working where I used to live in the Southwest in New Mexico. So yeah, you're right. There's a lot we can do there. And on the food front, Jason, I think in terms of capitalist and corporate excesses, could you talk for a sec about what's happening in local economy with food systems and CSAs?
Well, apparently CSAs are really on a rise, so there's a huge demand for that. So that stands for Community Supported Agriculture. It's essentially a subscription service. So you pay a farm to grow the food for you. It tends to be tilted towards fresh fruits and vegetables, although some CSAs will do things like add more staple grains or eggs, or they'll have partners with other people that are doing things like honey and meats. So there's a little bit of a move to try to allow people to, through some subscription service or pay as you go partially, to get near a full diet. And apparently they're really taking off. And I'm involved in one right now. And I know of people, for example, who lost all their restaurant accounts, but suddenly they're able to sell direct to homes and it's making up for all that. So there's a lot of people really stepping up in a sense to sort of support local farms.
I mean, there's a lot of ways on these fault lines. Like you said, Asher, there's no simple answer. There's no way to just have some panacea that we figure out how to do this all at once. But you can certainly find ways to engage, you know, that range from join a CSA and buy some local food on up to go run for office, right? Yeah. That whole range of possibilities for dealing with some of this mess.
The big thing is when we try to stitch this back together again, let's not rebuild the same goddamn system that we had.
I don't think we are going to be able to. It's Humpty Dumpty at this point, but yeah. You know, what are we going to build? And I think that's what's so amazing about this time is that we actually, in a release phase, you have the opportunity to pick up pieces and put them back together in new ways. And it's kind of exciting.
So unlike the King's Men, we can get out there and join the Humpty Dumpty CSA, make some omelets, and actually put the pieces back together. Is that the moral of this story?
It won't be the same egg, though.
And I have the Humpty Dance song in my head right now, I'm sorry to say. I wish we could play it for people.
Well, at least we got past the Brady Bunch. So, you know, that song is no longer
except in your you head. Just said it. God damn it.
Well, let's move on then to Quarantine Corner.
I want to start, please, if I may. Being in quarantine, as everyone knows, has been surreal. I really feel for the graduates that aren't going to get to walk across that stage and shake hands. But the thing that's actually on my mind most right now is we lucked into being able to add a family member. We got a dog. I've never had a dog in my household, and we have one that it's very fitting for the kinds of things I talk about. The breed is a mix, and you could call it a Bernedoodle, which is a Bernese mountain dog and a poodle. But I think more to the point, you can call it a Bernese mountain poo.
Good.
So it's a pretty big dog, I take it.
Yeah, it's an 8-month-old puppy at this point, and it's about 50 pounds. So I hope it doesn't get a lot bigger than that, because it'll probably take me out.
Well, my quarantine corner is the experience I had today riding my bike to the office where I was attempting to record the session. I ended up having to go back home to do it with you guys. But on my way, riding through the campus of Oregon State University and seeing today is, or yesterday, I guess, was the first day that the state lifted restrictions. You know, we're in phase one of opening up the economy again. That means some businesses can reopen, including some restaurants. Now, they're supposed to follow certain restrictions or whatever expectations. I'm assuming around social distancing and stuff. What I saw on my way was not evidence of that. It was a bunch of college students who were really happy to be outside on a sunny day, sitting at picnic tables, all huddled together, not a mask among them, drinking beer. And yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier about how social we are as creatures. I don't blame people for wanting to get together, but I really, really worry about what things are going to look like in a few weeks as we reopen this country up.
Well, you know, you're risking the wrath of Jason with that story. Now, can you stay calm for your quarantine
corner?
That's
a trigger for me, though, because what happened in phase one is fantastic for me because, quote unquote, there's an opening of gyms, which is, I think, kind of idiotic.
Sure.
I don't want to be doing downward dog in my yoga studio or anything like that. But that was interpreted by my tennis club as like, we can play tennis, which I think is a lot safer than like lifting weights or whatever.
Yeah, that is. You're actually at a distance unless you guys are hitting each other at the net.
Pretty good distancing in tennis. So I've got tennis scheduled for next week. Now, what I'm worried about is that the Yahoos at this restaurant, which I know the name, I'm not going to say it, and I guess the health department's talking to them because enough people complained.
Oh, is that true?
Yes, I have some inside information here.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. So I hope that there's more responsible behavior because I don't want to go back to phase zero. Phase one allows me to play tennis.
Got it. Back to the self-interest.
Yes.
That's the motto for your life. I don't want to go back to phase zero.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually what parents are going to be saying to kids when they're acting out. If you don't stop this, we're going to go back to phase zero.
That's right.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Enjoy your spring. Get out. Enjoy yourself.
Yeah. And if you go out, please, please practice good distancing and good hygiene.
Yeah.
All right. Take care, you guys. See you next time in Crazy Town.